When I originally was expecting to come here, I planned to speak on some dry points of the history of crypto mathematics. But this really isn't the best environment for that, so I decided to broaden the talk a little bit. I like to talk about what I call turning points in cryptography. I'm just going to discuss more than one, but I'm going to focus in on some things around World War II, particularly having to do with Bletchley Park, but not exclusively. But to set the stage for that, the turning point in cryptography, although it occurs in two places and 700 years apart, there is one distinct sort of set of discoveries. First by Al-Kindi and presumably colleagues in Baghdad in the 9th century AD, 2nd century AH, and then again in Rome by Alberti and Battista and some other people. Vigenère, who's sort of the best known, he was the VP of marketing, I think. Basically, before this, you had what we now, roughly speaking, call code books. And it comes in two forms. I mean, the small form, you have a cipher alphabet, and then because it's tedious to write everything out in full length, you have a set of abbreviations called a nomenclator. And it's possible for that the nomenclator to prolapse up into a 100,000 main entry dictionary, but you still don't have all the words in the world, and so you add what are called spelling groups. And there's a certain body of cryptanalysis associated with attacking these things. What was discovered, and I'll focus on the European path because I know it better, is what we now call polyalphabetic encryption, and all of the systems they worked against, no, not all the ones they worked against, but all the ones we were hearing about are examples of polyalphabetic encryption. And the basic notion is you have a cipher alphabet and you keep changing it from character to character to character. And that defeats the kind of, you know, paper and pencil techniques used against the Sunday Times puzzles in which you're doing frequency counts and vowel line contacts and things of that kind, or it forces you to refine them dramatically. And it's amazing how similar the highest grade symmetric crypto systems today are. I mean, the principles have not changed. And there are really, in computer science terms, there are two things there. You have some kind of arithmetic and what's called modular arithmetic, you know, get to 26 and start over again at 1, just like a clock that gets to 12 and starts over again at 1. And you have lookup tables, whether you call them cipher alphabets or F-boxes or S-boxes or code books or whatever. So you do those two things, and the quality is all in how you combine them. That's point one. It takes 400 years from the European work to come to the next things, and two things come in right together. The first is Marconi's first transatlantic radio transmission in 1904. That's sort of, so to speak, the pull. Telegraph had created some interest in cryptography, but not an overwhelming interest. You sort of knew where telegraph wires went. You could do something about your security. And, you know, information security prior to the 20th century, you know, then you had to lock their doors and lock their safes and guard their buildings and things of that kind. Send things in diplomatic pouches. Suddenly radio appears and it bypasses everything. It's so incredibly valuable, you can't afford not to use it, and yet the only security technique you have is this 400-year-old, at that time, body of lore, and you don't really know much about it for a very important reason. You basically cannot do enough polyalphabetic encryption by hand. If you try to do it by hand, you make too many errors, and you never get any messages through. It took until you had electromechanical computation, or at least high-grade machining and good mechanical computation, suddenly for those things to come into their own. And what pushed this was World War I. All of a sudden, World War I, the code clerks are swamped, the cryptography isn't very good, the inventors get to thinking. And the earliest claim is a Dutch claim to an Enigma in 1915. Solitaire claims are Hebern's in the U.S., I think it's 1918. Shortly after that, Servius and Dam with a patent in Germany. And you now get these mechanical devices, of which Enigma are the, as a marketing matter, probably the most successful family, that dominate military cryptography in most respects until the 50s, maybe the 60s, of an important NATO machine called the KL-7 wasn't retired till the 80s. And this brought us into World War II with a fairly substantial cryptographic technology. But there are two rotor machines and one rotor-like machine that are especially worthy of notice. One of these, the high-grade U.S. system, was called SIGABA. And it is two rotor machines in one package. The problem with rotor machines, if you look at something like Enigma, the fact is the rotors do not move very irregularly. Enigma has what's called odometer motion. The one rotor turns around till it gets all the way around, and then there's a click, and the next one moves by one step. And so the motion's rather predictable, and the mechanisms that we use to attack it are based on that fact. SIGABA, very loosely speaking, is an Enigma-quality machine which manufactures the motions for another machine. So there are two five-rotor machines in one package, and as it happens, the way you do it is to stick four hot wires into the first one and gather the output into five groups and feed those to move the five rotors of the second machine. The second rotor machine I consider really worth noting is British. There's a machine called Typex. And Typex looks very much like an Enigma, but at its heart, it isn't really. Because Typex put two wirings inside the rotor. An Enigma has this pattern that a signal comes in one end, goes down the bank of rotors, gets reflected at the other end, and comes back. And what that means is its character can never be enciphered into itself. There's a reason for doing it this way, which is sort of now the motion mechanism. You get twice as much advantage out of the motion mechanism, but you pay for it with a disadvantage. What Typex realizes is that, well, it's actually cheap, maybe not in doing the original building, but in reliability characteristics, to add a second wiring inside each rotor. So effectively now it's two rotors, one inside the other. And a signal comes down through the, let us say, the outer wirings and gets reflected, comes back through the inner wirings. So now you have the characteristics of a straight-through machine, but you have a lot of the advantage of each wheel coming into play twice, so the motions sort of count double. The third thing I want just to mention is a Japanese system. They snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. It is one of the most brilliant insights of early 20th century cryptography, that it is a little silly to use rotors. Nobody wants rotors except cryptographers. That means you have to pay for rotors out of the communication security budget. And they're ordinary complex, electromechanical engineering objects. Bakelite cylinders, they might have a fancy metal center. They have brass contacts around the edge. They are subject to carbonization and arcing and all sorts of problems. Something else will do the same job, and it was developed out of the vastly larger general communications budget, and that is a telephone stepping switch. People were routinely building telephone central offices out of thousands of stepping switches. You knew that they worked reliably. You go down, in this case, to Nippon Telegraph and Telephone, and you buy them. At that point, unfortunately for them, very fortunately for us, they made the actual cryptographic characteristics of the design lousy. They used 14 of these things, where they probably should have used 30 to 50. And one of the other big stories of World War II is how the Japanese traffic was read, and that came to light a bit earlier than the Bletchley work because of the joint Pearl Harbor hearings in the late 40s to decide why, despite the fact they were reading the traffic, they hadn't let anybody know what they found out. So World War II, like World War I, creates a great market for cryptography, and a lot of things are done. And one of the U.S. ones, and here I may come slightly into conflict with things that were said earlier, the SIG-SALI project, that secured voice device, is tremendously important. And I believe that it is a very, very, very different device from Delilah. All secure voice devices up till then, and many after that, have been things that, in order to work well on the available communication channels, for example, dial-up telephone or single sideband radio, work by analog distortion of the voice, very frequently controlled by a digital crypto system. So, as in the Visionaire ciphers, it rolls from sample to sample. And different things are done. SigSally works entirely differently. SigSally has a 2400 bit per second vocoder. That is to say, it produces digital output that represents voice, just the way all of our modern things, from DVDs to contemporary secure phones, do. And as it happens, the encryption mechanisms, one of them was very high grade but very crude, that 16-inch long playing records, and they used one-time material. It also has what seems now to be lost, an electromechanical crypto system that could be used with it. One of the U.S. cryptographers told me he'd been looking for it and he couldn't find it in the archive. SigSally is important for two very different reasons. One, it showed people, at least in the U.S., that secure voice could be done. Remember, you're fighting the Second World War. You have good secure record traffic, or both U.S. and Britain did, at 10 characters a second. But you get onto the radio, and you're stuck with this, you know, gold leader to blue wingman, you have a bogey on your tail, sort of, right, stuff. SigSally occupied a room this size. Flowers showed up with a ton of equipment in the back of a truck. I think SigSally weighed 30 tons. And it's 30 racks of equipment, each approximately a ton. They're standard 7-foot telephone racks. Initially, it was so expensive, only two people, you know, I only had two subscribers on the network. That was Churchill and Roosevelt. But the 4-star generals all got real excited, and by the end of the 40s, there were about a dozen of these things. There's a critical point here, that you cannot really do mechanical encryption at the speed you need. I know there's a slight contradiction with what I said about the system whose workings I don't know, that was the electromechanical system for SigSally. I can't explain that. But fundamentally, even if you figure 10 characters a second is, say, 120 bits a second, including sync or something, you have 12 bits per character. Maybe it's slower than that. 2400-bit vocoder is equivalent to 120 characters a second versus 10. And so you've got to do something else. At the same time, computers were being developed, and you had shift register technology for adders. So you're manipulating single bits, you have some hot point of action in the register, and bits move by and you do something to them. And so what are called shift register systems, things that have a string of bits and a basic operation that moves them left or right, became the new up-and-coming thing in cryptography. And the things of that period are what are called long cycle systems. And in a very important sense, they're very much like the Tunney machine, the SZ40. It manufactured a sequence of bits that it added, five at a time. It had Baudot characters, five bits, and it added these to the plain text. And that is most ciphertext traffic in the world is encrypted that way today. That's the most straightforward way of doing it. It doesn't suffer from a lot of error extension. Now we get back to the dry piece of crypto mathematics that I was going to try to get through without even a blackboard. So Enigma-like machines are dominated by things that are visibly characters. SZ40, T52-like machines, and everything later, basically, you see the bits very visibly. You may interpret the bits as characters, you may interpret the bits of frames of voice or something else, but basically, there are streams of bits. Now, in late teens, an American named Friedman wrote a paper on what he called the index of coincidence. So imagine looking at two adjacent lines in a book and noting how often one letter is above the other, fixed font. That's called the index of coincidence between the two lines. And for any given language, there tends to be a certain fraction of agreements in two pieces of text like that, that are lined up side by side. The significance of that cryptographically is that if you imagine taking two Enigma machines, same key, same starting positions, and encrypt two pieces of German with them, then the ciphertext will have the same index of coincidence as the plain text. You found a phenomenon that was preserved by the encryption, and that allows you, and this is loosely speaking what a Colossus does, you're sliding along doing a lot of correlations and finding how things are related to each other. Now, as late as 1937, a man named Solomon Kulbach, who's kind of the American analog I realized today to I.J. Goode. I.J. Goode made a great reputation for himself after the war as a probability and statistics theorist, as did Solomon. Donald Mickey, incidentally, I think it's in your book, has this wonderful, wonderful quote from me. Said a man came through the door and said, "How do you do? I'm good." And I have never had reason to doubt him. So you have the index of coincidence. Now you imagine you go to binary and you make this tiny change. Instead of looking at just the agreements, you look at the agreements minus the disagreements. And that happens to be called in cryptography the bulge. And if you describe it that way, it doesn't look very significant. I mean, if you know the total length of the sequence, you know the agreements, you know the rest of them disagreed, you can figure either one out from the other. But as it happens, that has the form of something very important in mathematics, and therefore very well studied by mathematicians. This is the sort of the same thing as going buying your stepping switches from NTT rather than developing and manufacturing rotors yourself. If the mathematicians have done it for you already, you don't have to redo it. Same thing with signal processing, a lot of things in engineering, etc. Whenever you can take a field like cryptanalysis and you can find that a piece of it has been done for you by somebody else, you do your best to import it. So the mathematicians have a much fancier way of writing agreements minus disagreements. Suppose you imagine anything to the power 0 is 1. So minus 1 to the 0 is 1. Anything to the power 1 is itself. So minus 1 to the 0 is 1, minus 1 to the 1 is minus 1. Now, if up in that exponent you put the difference of the two bits, it'll be either 0 or 1, and when they agree, you'll add a 1, when they disagree, you'll subtract a 1. So you get this, you know, funny expression that looks like summation of minus 1 to the f of x plus l of x, in the case I was writing. Now, why is that important? Well, that's a Fourier transform. It doesn't look terribly much like a Fourier transform. For those of you who are engineers, a Fourier transform normally looks like summation of e to the in theta. When we get to the greatest gem of cool mathematics, e to the I pi equals minus 1. That minus 1 is an e to the I pi. And now if you rewrite the thing, it is clear that it's a Fourier transform. I won't read it out again. I'm going to tell you why this is important. There is an incredibly important fact. It turns out in this case to be the second most important fact, in my view, in cryptanalysis. First is inside its functionality. As if you encrypt something in exactly the same circumstances, the same thing always encrypts to the same thing. You can conceal it up at the system level, message level. You can add different message indicator or something. You got a single character, exactly the same state, it's going to turn into the same single character. That one's the most important. But the second most important is a more arcane-sounding thing called Parseval's theorem. And what Parseval's theorem says in this context is that the sum of the squares of the bulges of any function with respect to all the linear functions is 1. Almost all of applied mathematics is about approximating nonlinear things with linear ones. Differential calculus is about approximating curves with their tangents. You know how to compute on the tangents. So if they approximate the curve, then you can get a good estimate of how the curve behaves. So this is a way of linearizing cryptographic functions. And what Parseval's theorem tells you is that there can be no purely nonlinear cryptographic function. It always correlates with some linear function. Now, one of the guys who was head of cryptanalysis at NSA a few years ago said, doing cryptanalysis in the 70s, every other word out of your mouth was bulge. This emerged as the dominant technique in, called linear cryptanalysis, incidentally, in the public world, the dominant technique for cryptanalyzing bit-oriented systems. When I first learned about this in the 80s, I just assumed that, you know, the bulge had been developed. I would have said, if somebody had asked me, I'd have said, I assume it was developed at NSA in the 50s at the time that they were building these nonlinear shift register systems. No. It's full-blown in the final report of the Newman Ring. Final report on Tunney with emphasis on statistical methods. Mickey Good and Timms are the authors of that report. A comparable report written by Turing hasn't been released yet. So I can't tell you exactly who's responsible for all of this. So you have simultaneously the development for offensive purposes of the analytic techniques that then turn out to be the basis of both offensive and defensive work in the sort of digital systems that were developed at that same era. Under this title, there are several interesting things that follow. The 50s are well known for the development of shift registers. And incidentally, they seem to develop at several places in the world. And the best explanation I have is the rise of computer adders and things like that. But I don't have a solid enough explanation to suit me. Somebody asked me a question here about transposition in modern systems. And the brief answer, I told you that you can't do very much polyalphabetic encryption without mechanical aids. Similarly, you can't do very much transposition without computer memory. You need to be able to store several characters at a time and work on them. Well, in about 1950, a new problem came up, a new practical problem. They'd had since early in the war what are called identification friend or foe systems. And they all work by having special waveforms. The RAF says the first one was that there's an antenna on some plane that was a wire antenna from the tail, probably to the back of the cockpit. And that was very visible on the radar. They knew how to do a snap roll that the radar operators knew about to tell them that it was friendly aircraft. That, of course, didn't last very long. The Germans learned how to do it, put such a wire on planes, whether they needed it for radio or not. And this started an arms race in which you kept developing more and more elaborate waveforms to send back to say, this is a friend of yours, don't shoot. There's a very important number in there, and so a lot of these things have a 2.9-second delay line. Why would do that? The radiation lab at MIT ordered 3-second delay lines, but they came back 2.9 seconds. This was the war. They didn't have time to wait for some more of them, and that number apparently is still in IFF equipment today. So they finally hit circa 1950, on what's now considered the obvious schemes called challenge and response or challenge and reply authentication. The fire control radar sends out an encrypted message saying, basically, if you're a friend of mine, you can transform this message in an appropriate way and send it back to me, and I'll refrain from telling the gun to shoot at you. And a group under Horst Feistel at the Air Force Research Center, then in Cambridge, Massachusetts, later in Bedford, began working. You can't do that with a stream cipher. Basically, you have to have what's now called a block cipher or electronic code book. And as it happened, this one received 32 bits of challenge and sent back 4. Why did it do that? Engineering backward compatibilities with things. So you have to do it a dozen or 20 times before you have any confidence you've got the right person. But that thing became what is now the Mark 12 IFF, which is used worldwide, and the crypto system for it. I don't know if that one's used anymore. It was called the KI-1. But that developed the principles that later were used in DES, the U.S. Data Encryption Standard, and are now used in basically all of the high-grade systems, in particular the Advanced Encryption Standard, which is a Belgian design that was adopted by the U.S. as its high-grade system. That's probably a good stopping place. I mean, I can ramble on a bit about the possibilities of quantum computing and things like that, but it would take a little build-up to get to my job. So I think maybe you guys would rather catch the last train than, you know, still be asking questions when the crows come home or whatever they do. So thank you very much.
Whitfield, thank you very much.